Chapter 12. Incorporation. At what point does a sense of pause yield to the sense of an ending? The book of Job is the climax of the Tanakh and the climactic moment in the biography of God. The books that then follow, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes, are in effect a denouement. The French word denouement means literally untangling. In drama, after the conflict that the dramatist has created has been essentially resolved, there always remains a further loosening and untangling, a final sorting out, before the play can come to a satisfying close. If nothing else, a little time must pass for the impact of the climax to be assimilated. It is in this last sense that the four books we considered in Chapter 11 function as a denouement. There are, yes, occasional points of contact between them and the Book of Job, the anguished tone of Lamentations, the resignation of Ecclesiastes, and a few others. But these links do not make them a final sorting out of the tangle of Job and God. They become a denouement principally by interposing a pause between the Book of Job and the books that end the Tanakh. They change the subject. They mark time. They lull. And then their sense of pause yields to something different, an elusive but eventually pervasive sense of movement and culmination. The biography of God, as we saw earlier, has several beginnings. God, Elohim, creates the world in one way. The Lord, Yahweh, in another. But if there had been no creation story, the Tanakh could have begun with Noah. If there had been no flood story, it could have begun with Abraham. If no patriarchal covenant, then with Moses. In the books to which we now turn, the Tanakh, with its several beginnings, comes to several endings. In each of these endings, God's life comes to a close, but in none of them does he die. We may say, keeping our focus tightly on him, that he subsides. But widening the focus somewhat, we may say that he is incorporated in the Jewish nation. The act by which God became man as Jesus Christ is referred to in Christian theology as the Incarnation, from the Latin word carnis, flesh. The Spirit of God became flesh in the person of Jesus. Incorporation, from the Latin corpus, body, is a similar concept, but one that carries no such theological freight. Judaism does not claim, even for the Jewish nation as a whole, the relationship with God that Christianity claims for Jesus. Nonetheless, leaving theological speculation aside, it does seem that in the books of Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles, a pragmatic transfer of functions and expectations occurs. Actions that once God would have taken on behalf of the Jews, statements that he would have made to them, they now take and make for themselves. God is still God and the only God. They are still no more than human beings. And yet, in a strange way, he and they exchange roles. Absence. He explained to them that he was a Jew. Esther. The evolution of the religion of ancient Israel into Judaism, and of the nation of Israel into world Jewry, is not the subject of this book, and in any event only the very first stages in that process are recorded at all in the Bible. The books of Esther and Daniel, neither of which contains any record of historical events, are both nonetheless of interest to historians as evidence of a changing national consciousness. They tell, respectively, the story of a woman and of a man rising to distinction at the imperial court of an empire in which the Jews are just one among many peoples. Esther, who becomes queen of the Persian Empire, uses her power to arm the Jews for action against their foes. Daniel, who becomes courtier, counselor, and chief magician to the king of Babylon, also achieves a violent, if narrower, triumph over his foes, and goes on to have a series of apocalyptic visions, in which Babylon and succeeding empires are destroyed, and Daniel's own nation triumphs. Though the attitude taken in Esther toward the Persian Empire is far more benign than that taken in Daniel toward the Babylonian, Persian, and Greek empires, both books take empires for granted. And in both books, a pattern that will be replicated innumerable times in 2,500 years of Jewish history is already operative. In this pattern, the Jews are an identifiable, vulnerable minority, hated by some, but thriving by dint of talent. Esther's beauty, Daniel's brilliance, and integrity. Their survival depends on their willingness to take risks for one another, on their skill in winning protection from the very top, and on their ability to determine in a timely manner the likely course of events, especially dangerous events. Fidelity to the Jewish religion need not always be an element in either Jewish identity or Jewish self-defense. The Book of Esther, scarcely less remarkable for its inclusion in the Bible than the Book of Ecclesiastes, marks something of an extreme in the separation of Jewish destiny from Jewish religion. God is not mentioned in this book, nor when the Jews are spoken of as a distinct minority within the Persian Empire, is their religion mentioned as even a secondary feature of their identity. They are merely an ethnic group, and the Book of Esther is the story of a triumphant episode in their history. The queen of Persia has offended her husband, and the king has decided to take a new wife. The most beautiful maidens of the realm are brought to Shushan, his capital city. Esther, an orphan adopted by her cousin Mordecai, pleases him most and becomes his queen. That her Jewish identity is a handicap is suggested by the fact that she conceals it from Ahasuerus, the king. But she has no compunction about marrying a Persian, and apparently makes no effort to practice her religion, even secretly. Meanwhile, in the book's second plot, Mordecai declines to kneel or bow low to Haman, who has recently been promoted to prime minister and enjoys this homage by royal edict. The courtiers importune Mordecai, who has recently saved the king from assassination by alerting Queen Esther, to comply, but he explained to them that he was a Jew, and this book comes no nearer than that to a religious commitment or allusion to God. Haman then says to Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed, a certain unassimilated nation scattered, as the Jerusalem Bible translates, among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. And it is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them. If it please your majesty, let an edict be drawn for their destruction, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the stewards for deposit in the royal treasury." Haman will presumably get this silver by plundering the Jews who will be slain. The reaction to this edict among the Jews is remarkable. When Mordecai learned all that had happened, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. Also, in every province that the king's command and decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and everybody lay in sackcloth and ashes. Fasting, sackcloth, and ashes were sometimes signs of repentance in ancient Israel, but Mordecai mentions no sin, does not summon the Jews to repentance, and does not speak of the king's decree as an act of God. Fasting, sackcloth, and ashes were also signs of mourning, and they seem to be no more than that in this case. They could also finally be employed in conjunction with prayer at the time of a personal, or especially a great national crisis. But in an extremely striking omission, neither Mordecai nor any of the Jews now in peril for their lives calls on the Lord in prayer. The omission is stunning because this decree of extermination so closely resembles that earlier decree of Pharaoh against the male infants of the Israelites. Whether or not, when they cried out, the Israelites in Egypt were consciously crying to their God, their cry for help rose up to God, and he heard it and came to their rescue. The cry of the Jews in Persia does not rise up to God. God takes no action on their behalf, and they give no indication whatsoever that they expect him to do so. On the contrary, they rescue themselves from this peril by their own courage and resourcefulness. When Esther fears to enter the king's presence unsummoned, a capital offense against the rules of the court, Mordecai urges her on. "Do not imagine that you, of all the Jews, will escape with your life by being in the king's palace. On the contrary, if you keep silent in this crisis, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another quarter, while you and your father's house will perish. And who knows, perhaps you have attained to royal position for just such a crisis." Mordecai's advice to Esther is forceful but worldly, in the way that Ecclesiastes' more general advice on the same point is worldly. "Two are better off than one, in that they have greater hope for their earnings. For should they fall, one can raise the other. But woe betide him who is alone and falls with no companion to raise him. Further, when two lie together, they are warm. But how can he who is alone get warm? Also, if one attacks, two can stand up to him. A threefold cord is not readily broken." Ecclesiastes, as we have noted, refers often, if casually, to God. Esther never refers to him. But we can imagine that in circumstances like those described in the book of Esther, Ecclesiastes would conduct himself more or less as Esther and Mordecai do. He too would spend little time talking to or of God. Parts of Ecclesiastes read indeed like slightly jaded advice to a courtier. "Don't revile a king even among your intimates. Don't revile a rich man even in your bedchamber. For a bird of the air may carry the utterance, and a winged creature may report the word. A little bird told me, as the saying still goes." The book of Esther, to a point, is the book of Ecclesiastes put into practice. Esther takes the risk Mordecai urges on her and wins big. The king, still smitten with her, offers her half his kingdom. Instead, she alerts him to the fact that Haman is planning the public execution of Mordecai, who, as the king has fortuitously discovered in palace archives, once tipped him off to a planned assassination. Esther further explains to her husband Haman's plan to exterminate the Jews, who are, she now reveals, her ancestral people. Outraged, the king gives Haman's fortune to Mordecai, executes Haman on the very gibbet Haman had prepared for Mordecai, and officially decrees a one-day immunity for the Jews to wreak revenge on any and all of their enemies. "If any people or province attacks them, they may destroy, massacre, and exterminate its armed force, together with women and children, and plunder their possessions. On a single day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely, on the 13th day of the 12th month, that is, the month of Adar." Esther asks for a second such day, and the king grants her request. The Jews slay 75,000, and otherwise wreak their will on their enemies. Later, in memory of their deliverance and of this revenge, they create the two-day feast of Purim, named for the poor or lot that Haman had cast to select Adar as the month when the Jews would die, the 14th and 15th days of Adar every year, the same days on which the Jews enjoyed relief from their foes, and the same month which had been transformed for them from one of grief and mourning to one of festive joy. The absence of even a passing reference to God in the Book of Esther has suggested deliberate exclusion to many commentators. The Purim holiday, a late addition to the Jewish calendar, quite probably borrowed from the Babylonians before the Book of Esther was written, became a kind of Jewish bacchanalia, and perhaps for that reason it may have been judged best to keep the divine name clear of association with it and possible desecration through it. On this reading, the Book of Esther is conscious historical fiction, written for entertainment, and its violence is no more, if no less, unedifying than the violence of an American-style action-adventure film in which the hero mows down hundreds of generic bad guys with his machine gun. The Septuagint translation of Esther, however, does refer to God, and in fact includes prayers by Mordecai and Esther, among its several substantial additions to the text. Though some of these references and additions, whose effect is to make the story more appropriate, prima facie, for inclusion in the Tanakh, may have been supplied by the Greek-speaking Jews of the Western diaspora, others may go back to an uncorrected Hebrew original. That is, to a time before all references to God were purged from the story. All of this lies in the realm of historical speculation. What remains is the actively rather than passively secular effect of the Hebrew text as placed in the Jewish canon. The Tanakh is a collection of books dealing in the main with the relationship between God and Israel. The supreme crisis in that relationship was Israel's mass apostasy from God and God's devastating punishment of Israel by defeat and exile. Their covenant, which had begun when he liberated them from slavery and imminent genocide in Egypt, seemed effectively to end as the land he had so long ago given them became the possession of foreign invaders. It is at that point that the formal narrative of the relationship between God and Israel, running from Exodus through 2 Kings, breaks off. To be sure, much can be inferred about divine and human hopes for a new beginning, even in the absence of narrative, from the pre-exilic and exilic prophets, and a good deal can be inferred about the actual new beginning from the post-exilic prophets. Yet through all the prophets and writings from Isaiah through Ecclesiastes, no formal narrative dealing with the further life of the nation as a whole has been encountered. After the last prophet, Malachi, moreover, the drift has been decidedly toward individual rather than collective concerns. For all these reasons, the resumption of the narrative in Esther, and the fact that the narrative resumed, do indeed deal with the collective destiny of the nation in its diaspora, lend this book an undeniable impact. Of all the occurrences of the words Jew and the Jews in the Tanakh, the great majority are found in this one book. In the earlier books of the Tanakh, the corresponding words are Israelite and Israel, the name of the nation, and its eponymous ancestor, referring collectively to all who belonged to it. Israel was a 12-tribe union within which the Jews, the sons of Judah, were one tribe. Reference was rarely made to the sons of Judah as Judahites, Judeans, or Jews, however. The collective word for them was Judah, and they were rarely referred to in any other way. That the resumption of the narrative of national history should coincide with this crucial change in self-designation only makes Esther, the book in which the resumption occurs, that much more important. Israel is back, as we might put it, now calling itself the Jews, still speaking Hebrew, still beyond confusion with any other nation, but amazingly without its God. This last inference would not be required if the Book of Esther took any other shape than the one it does. If, in other words, it were not a story of genocide averted, mimicking the very foundation myth of the nation. The power of the Exodus memory as a paradigm of divine redemption from genocide is such that when the threat that led to the Exodus is so nearly duplicated, God cannot be merely and neutrally absent from the story. If he does not intervene to save his people, or at the very minimum, if they do not so much as call upon him in their hour of peril, then he seems aggressively dismissed from their story. Whatever the intent of the Book of Esther, this is the effect. There are certain households in which certain words may not be spoken. Years may go by in which no discussion is permitted of why they may not be spoken, but the silence continues and is heard at every moment. Whatever the intent of the silence about God in the Book of Esther, this is its effect. Esther and Mordecai are not God incarnate. To call them that, one would need at least to speak the word God. But they are very nearly God's redemptive action incarnate. They do for the Jews under Ahasuerus what the Lord did for Israel under Pharaoh. They do what the Lord's anointed was once expected to do again for a restored Israel. It may go without saying that the Lord's anointed, the Messiah, is not mentioned in Esther, and the very word Israel never crosses the protagonist's lips. Literarily, the Book of Esther is sometimes joined to the books of Judith and Tobit, works originally written in Hebrew or Aramaic, but preserved only in Greek translation in the Septuagint. All three are edifying historical fiction about Jews living under foreign rule. But in that characterization of them, the key word is edifying. For one man's edification can always be another man's scandal. Judith and Tobit are far more pious than Esther. In both, alongside the valor of the human protagonist, help continues to come in the name of the Lord. But neither of them is included in the Jewish canon, and Esther is. To speculate at any length about why this is so would be to stray too far into the history of diaspora Jewry. But, as a bare minimum, one cannot rule out that Esther was included precisely because it does not wait on the Lord for redemption. Somebody back there may have liked it for just that reason. And it is quite striking to link its self-reliance with the self-reliance of Nehemiah, another Persian Jew who takes defense of the Jews as his responsibility rather than God's. Historians rightly read Esther as fiction and Nehemiah as history. But there is an important spiritual link between the two. But even if nobody back there liked Esther for any such reason, and from the beginning there have been both Jewish and Christian objections to it, even if the literary effect of its placement is purely accidental, the effect remains. When, in the Book of Esther, wicked men plot against the Jews of Shushan, and when the Jews do not cry out to God for relief from this injustice as the psalmist does, something changes. Though the Jews are grief-stricken and almost panic-stricken over the threat to their lives, their sense of grievance stops with the human beings involved. And their sense of panic does not prevent them from taking decisive, autonomous action. This too changes something. From India to Nubia, the extent of Ahasuerus's empire, according to the Book of Esther, the Jews have become, as it were, God's ex-wife, now responsible for her own debts only, God's former client now representing herself, God's grown-up child moved out of the house. The Jews' world is sometimes hostile, but with talent, courage, and a little luck, they are making a go of it. As for God, he is, to all seeming, no longer any concern of theirs. Ancient of Days. Seal the book until the end of time. Daniel. Though there is something terminal about the Book of Esther, it is not the last book in the Tanakh, and its last word or studied silence about God is not final either. In the book of Daniel, God and Israel, at least through intermediaries, are together again. Daniel, like Esther, is a Jew at an imperial court. But God is also present in the book of Daniel as the acknowledged source of success, as he is not in any corresponding way in the book of Esther. Esther is a single, continuous narrative, whereas Daniel consists of a set of tales from the hero's life at the Babylonian court, followed by a set of visions. But at least the first half of Daniel may be considered a kind of religious version of Esther. Perhaps the clearest single contrast between Esther and Daniel in this regard is that between two episodes in which particularly devious enemies of the Jews are hoist by their own petard. In Esther 5 through 7, Haman ends up impaled on a 50-cubit stake he had raised for the execution of Mordecai. In Daniel 6, Daniel's persecutors die in the lion's den that they had prepared for his execution. Mordecai's offense scarcely exceeded, if it exceeded at all, personal disrespect for Haman, whereas Daniel's offense was the specifically religious one of defying a decree, issued to entrap him, that for 30 days all prayer should be offered only to the king. Mordecai's vindication, by the same token, is a purely personal, or personal and national, triumph, whereas Daniel's redounds to God's worldwide credit. The king in Daniel writes to all the peoples and nations of every language that inhabit the earth, "May your well-being abound. I have hereby given an order that throughout my royal domain men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God who endures forever. His kingdom is indestructible, and his dominion is to the end of time. He delivers and saves, and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, for he delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." The book of Daniel opens with the protagonist and three other young Jews, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, at the court of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, brought there as captives after Nebuchadnezzar's sack of Jerusalem. These opening chapters are akin in mood to the closing chapters of the book of Genesis, in which Joseph, brought to Egypt as a captive, rises to power at the court of Pharaoh. Like Joseph in his day, Daniel and his friends are more astute than the other attendants at the royal court. Whenever the king put a question to them requiring wisdom and understanding, he found them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and exorcists throughout his realm. Daniel's special expertise, like Joseph's, is in divination by dream interpretation. But there are differences. When Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dream of 7 fat cows and 7 lean cows and so on, God assisted him in reading a course of events that was not itself the result of a divine plan. The God who was assisting Joseph was not so great a God as that. Great enough to know what was going on, but not great enough to determine what would go on. He was, as we said in discussing Joseph, a personal God with a limited mandate. And though Joseph enjoyed God's steadfast love and acknowledged God's help, he did not speak to God either in petition or in thanksgiving. By contrast, Daniel extravagantly thanks the God of heaven, who is also the God of my fathers, for revealing the meaning of Nebuchadnezzar's dream to him in a night vision. And as he does so, he honors this God as the cause of the very events whose course he has now revealed. Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons, removes kings and installs kings. He gives the wise their wisdom and knowledge to those who know. He reveals deep and hidden things, knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I acknowledge and praise you, O God of my fathers, you who have given me wisdom and power, for now you have let me know what we asked of you. You have let us know what concerns the king. The outcome of this revelation is, in the spirit of Isaiah, both that the Gentiles recognize the true God, and that in the process the Jews prosper. Daniel explains Nebuchadnezzar's dream, stressing to the king that he is able to do so only because there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and because this God chooses to open the future to Nebuchadnezzar through Daniel. In reply, the king says, "Truly your God must be the God of gods and Lord of kings, and the revealer of mysteries, to have enabled you to reveal this mystery." And he showers gifts on Daniel and appoints him and his companions to high public office. God seems, behind the scenes, to have become quite active again. And yet, as we shall see, there is a subtle change. A part of the literary effect of the Book of Esther is that it is played out entirely in the present. Like a movie, and indeed like a movie with scarcely any backstory. History and memory are, by sharpest contrast with the rest of the Tanakh, of no consequence in the Book of Esther. And this may be no accident. The Jewish memory was, quintessentially, a memory of the mighty acts of God. And the Jews of the Book of Esther no longer look to God. Daniel differs from Esther by being more typically Jewish, looking both backward and forward, and continuing to expect divine action. Yet for Daniel, history has become more a theater for viewing the action than an arena for taking part in it. And this sometimes seems to go for Daniel's God as well. Ecclesiastes, we may recall, believed that the past and the future, though they could not be known, were entirely predetermined and recurrent. Daniel stops short of asserting complete predetermination, much less recurrence. More autonomy than that is reserved for God. And yet we can discern a nascent sense of history, as, to use an anachronistic image, a vast reel of film whose contents can be known before it is projected. That God may have made the film counts for less than that he or his angels can, at their discretion, either provide a preview of it, or, as we shall shortly see, prevent its release indefinitely. It is the miracle of prediction, fortune-telling at the international level, rather than any battlefield miracle, that is expected to humble the Gentiles and bring them to the worship of the true God. Thus, in Daniel 4, Daniel predicts a time of personal humiliation and misery for Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar, after the prediction has come true and the time of trial is behind him, blesses the Most High and praises and glorifies the ever-living One. Pharaoh had to be brought by God's mighty hand and outstretched arm to a temporary acknowledgment of God. Even when divinely caused disaster does befall a Gentile enemy, as it befalls Belshazzar on the night when the famous handwriting on the wall appears at his feast, God's power is proven less by the fact that Belshazzar is defeated than by the fact that the defeat was predicted. When Darius the Mede overthrows Belshazzar the Babylonian, the Jews may merely exchange one ruler for another. But if, through their God, they have unique intellectual access to this and future such changes, they have another kind of mastery over their condition. Increasingly, knowledge is power, and almost more than power. In the latter six chapters of Daniel, which have no parallel in Esther, this emphasis on knowledge only grows more pronounced. Knowledge was also important to the psalmist, of course, who found the thoughts of God as expressed in Torah weighty or precious. The abiding value of the law, both as a guide to life and as an avenue to intimacy with God, accomplished a kind of rescue from the failure of prophecy. But it was, after all, only the second, restorational half of prophecy that had proven a disappointment. The first, judgmental half, had been a success to the extent that the punishments which the pre-exilic prophets predicted, the defeats, the exile, did come to pass. Those disasters, paradoxically, could continue to be counted among the mighty acts of God, the proofs of His power. But a new kind of disaster defied that kind of conceptualization. The plausibility of the earlier linkage rested on the fact that disaster had followed upon an undeniable mass apostasy. Later, however, the Jews began to be persecuted because they were being faithful to their God. Persecutions of this sort, which took place historically when the Greeks succeeded the Persians as rulers of the Near East, are alluded to in Daniel's visions. In these visions, the author draws on the Jews' now extensive experience of empires rising and falling to inscribe their current misfortunes in a larger apocalyptic vision of disaster, overcoming a long series of empires, until, at length, God and His people are victorious. The vision is consoling, for all its short-term horror, because it eliminates that which always makes pain least bearable, namely the sense that one has been gratuitously singled out to suffer. "Golden lads and girls all must," Shakespeare wrote, "as chimney sweepers come to dust." In Daniel's apocalyptic vision, the golden lads are named Sargon and Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus and Alexander. The fact that all of them, without exception, will come to dust makes it more bearable that, at the time of writing, it is Israel that looks like a chimney sweeper. In the end, of course, what consoles most is not the fall of empires as such, but Israel's glorious victory. Daniel 7 is a vision of successive inhuman beasts, one more hideous than the next, until at length one like a human being appears. The subhuman beasts are the Gentile empires, whose rule is temporary. The triumphant human being is the Jews, whose rule, when it comes, will be eternal. The dominion of the other beasts was taken away, but an extension of life was given to them for a time and season. As I looked on in the night vision, one like a human being came with the clouds of heaven. He reached the Ancient of Days and was presented to him. Dominion, glory, and kingship were given to him. All peoples and nations of every language must serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship one that shall not be destroyed. Daniel does not know until it is explained to him what this vision means, but the explanation, very notably, does not come from the Ancient of Days, God himself, but from an attendant, who explains to Daniel that the last beast in the series will speak words against the Most High, and will harass the holy ones of the Most High. He will think of changing times and laws, and they will be delivered into his power for a time, times, and half a time. Then the court will sit, and his dominion will be taken away, to be destroyed and abolished for all time. The kingship and dominion and grandeur belonging to all the kingdoms under heaven will be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. In the explanation, what is most remarkable is the phrase, "Then the court will sit." Fleetingly, we have heard of or seen a heavenly court before. At the creation, in Isaiah's inaugural vision, in Micaiah's description of the heavenly adjudication of wars between Syria and Israel, in the book of Job, and on a few other occasions. But action taken by any member of the heavenly court but God himself has been exceedingly rare. Here the attendant who explains the vision to Daniel seems to be not just a manifestation of God, as several times in the book of Genesis, but a distinct being in a heavenly assembly taking collective action. This impression is both strengthened and complicated in Daniel 8, when, after seeing another vision of the end, Daniel overhears two holy beings speaking to each other. He then sees one who looked like a man, and hears a voice, not necessarily or even presumably the voice of God, call out, "Gabriel, make that man understand the vision." The famous angel Gabriel makes here his first appearance in the Bible, and he explains to Daniel that the vision he has seen was a representation of the end of time. Daniel, dismayed, is told to keep the vision a secret, since it pertains to far-off days. In Daniel 9, Daniel has been reading Jeremiah, and at Jeremiah 25:12, he has come upon the prediction that 70 years after the fall of Jerusalem to Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon itself will fall. Having read this passage, Daniel puts on sackcloth and ashes, fasts, and prays at great length to God, confessing abjectly and repeatedly that the disaster is the direct result of Israel's disobedience, but imploring God's intervention. And then, "While I was speaking, praying, and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and laying my supplication before the Lord my God on behalf of the holy mountain of my God, while I was uttering my prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had previously seen in the vision, was sent forth in flight and reached me about the time of the evening offering. He made me understand by speaking to me and saying, 'Daniel, I have just come forth to give you understanding. A word went forth as you began your plea, and I have come to tell it, for you are precious. So mark the word and understand the vision.'" The visions of Daniel are dated, by the book of Daniel itself, to just before and after the fall of Babylon to the Persians. But by their placement in the literary sequence of the Tanakh, they are effectively read at a later date. Persia, as we saw in the book of Esther, is long established, and a group of Jews have returned to Jerusalem as well. It is for their benefit that the 70 years of Jeremiah is reinterpreted by Gabriel as 70 weeks of years, thus saving the text and restoring the hope of a still future definitive victory for God's holy ones, as they are sometimes called in this book. Gabriel divides this 490-year period for Daniel, alluding to various past or future events. The particulars of the vision are less important, however, than is the fact that Scripture as written and consulted has now a divinatory importance matching that of dreams or visions, and that again and still God himself is inactive and silent. God's Bible is replacing the Bible's God. Gabriel returns in Daniel 10 in the guise of a man dressed in linen, his loins girt in fine gold. His body was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and legs had the color of burnished bronze, and the sound of his speech was like the noise of a multitude. With him, Gabriel brings news of war in heaven. He had sought to come quickly to Daniel's aid, he says. However, the prince of the Persian kingdom, a heavenly being allied with Persia, opposed me for 21 days. Now Michael, a prince of the first rank, has come to my aid, after I was detained there with the kings of Persia. So I have come to make you understand what is to befall your people in the days to come, for there is yet a vision for those days. Now I must go back to fight the Prince of Persia. When I go off, the Prince of Greece will come in. No one is helping me against them except your Prince Michael. However, I will tell you what is recorded in the Book of Truth. What follows is a long, coded, but decipherable account of the rise and fall of several empires in the Near East. Their rising and falling is not attributed to any action by God, nor is it even claimed as part of a vast divine plan. Though Gabriel knows its outcome in advance, he claims no further control over it, even in God's name, until the very end. At that time, the great prince, Michael, who stands beside the sons of your people, will appear. It will be a time of trouble, the like of which has never been seen since the nation came into being. At that time, your people will be rescued, all who are found inscribed in the book. Many of those that sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to eternal life, others to reproaches, to everlasting abhorrence. And the knowledgeable will be radiant like the bright expanse of sky, and those who lead the many to righteousness will be like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, keep the word secret, and seal the book until the time of the end. If in the book of Esther God seems to have abdicated in favor of Esther and Mordecai, in the book of Daniel he seems to have abdicated in favor of Gabriel and Michael, the counselor and the warrior prince, who, respectively, will guide and defend the nation until its final victory. Clearly, the struggle will be a difficult one. If there is a heavenly prince of Persia and a prince of Greece, presumably there are other princes as well. The time when they were an anonymous flutter of wings about the throne of the single, overwhelmingly dominant God seems to have passed. Satan's assertion of his malign power against Job now seems to have been only a harbinger of other angelic beings to come. Ultimate victory is still assured to the righteous, but there is little hope in the interim for more than an understanding of the stages in the tribulation. I heard and did not understand, so I said, "My Lord Gabriel, what will be the outcome of these things?" He said, "Go, Daniel, for these words are secret and sealed to the time of the end. Many will be purified and purged and refined. The wicked will act wickedly, and none of the wicked will understand, but the knowledgeable will understand." There was something cold about this vision. Though it is a vision of victory, it is scarcely one of reconciliation, world peace, the lion lying down beside the lamb, the nations streaming to Zion to learn the law, and so on. It is not even a vision of idyllic prosperity in a land flowing with milk and honey. The imagining of the end has been, in effect, impoverished by the imagining of stages en route to the end. The righteous may hope to be like the stars of the sky, but the awe that the psalmist brought to every mention of the stars is missing. God has made his final silent appearance, and the story that began with his creation of light and of the firmament and of the stars has ended with the stars. In the beginning has been projected to the end, the final victory. And just here, on this nominally triumphant but oddly flat note, the biography of God comes to its second ending. Through to the end of the book of Daniel, the faint possibility of God's return has remained. Now it is gone. God has done what God had to do. Others, one way or another, will now carry his work forward. There have been moments of triumph. The books of Chronicles are appended precisely to recall them before the Tanakh ends. There have been moments of splendid, blind confidence. There have also been moments of rash anger, of perhaps equally rash repentance, and at least one moment of something like shame. But there are to be no further such moments, no further links in the chain. The Ancient of Days, as Daniel now calls him, is not dead but old, and, by implication, weary. Undefeated, undestroyed, he is somehow retired from the scene. The multiplicity that characterized him at his most vigorous does not collapse to unity and then to nullity in his gradual disappearance. But he seems only the more poignantly real for that failure to collapse definitively and cleanly. Nothing that literature contrives, after all, is so artificial as its endings. Real lives never end with artistic finality. Either they are rudely interrupted, as Ecclesiastes says, or they end in a slow fade that has none of the rounded perfection of a well-wrought last page. Real lives end, we might say, just as God's life ends. A supreme effort falls slightly short. The voice from the whirlwind. A long period opens in which one has progressively less to say, and the devotion of one's friends is slowly overtaken by their silence. A final claim is mounted that one's counsel has always mattered more than one's prowess, and the claim helps, but only somewhat. And then the lights fail.